You are listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our Canada conversations with more from the race for U.S. House, where we now turn to Democrat Sarah McBride. McBride was elected to the Delaware State Senate in 2020, representing the Wilmington area 1st District, and won re-election unopposed in 2022. She previously served as the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, the country's largest LGBTQ advocacy organization, and during the 2016 Democratic National Convention became the first openly transgender person to address a national party convention. A reminder, the Canada conversations you hear here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. So let's talk about some of these issues that you've already touched on a little bit, starting with the economy, because voters consistently list that as a top issue. Biden administration touts low unemployment, relatively strong job numbers over recent months, along with some other positive economic indicators, as signs the country is headed in the right direction. But inflation and higher prices on many everyday goods still leave a lot of people struggling. So what would you be supporting in Congress and doing in Congress to promote economic growth, to help those, as I guess you said, the kitchen table issues that people are facing?
Sure. Well, the number one priority for the next Congress has to be bringing down costs facing workers and families in Delaware and across the country. It means investing in more affordable housing here in Delaware. It means passing legislation guaranteeing affordable childcare for every single family in our state, including universal pre-K. It means passing paid family and medical leave at the federal level to build on the progress that we've made here in Delaware so that workers no longer have to choose between their health and their job, between their paycheck and their family. It means investing in healthcare to bring down the costs facing patients across our state by helping recruit more providers here in Delaware and expanding coverage to communities and for services that too long had been denied coverage. It means bringing down these costs that in many cases break the bank when families face them. But in so many instances, these are inevitable challenges of life. And we can do more to support people and their families as they face those inevitable challenges. And if we invest in childcare, in housing, in healthcare, we'll address some of the most significant drivers of the cost increases that our families are facing. But in order to do that, we actually have to get things done. And so from day one, I'll be focused on those policies that'll impact families in their pocketbooks and help make the American dream more affordable for them.
Where does tax policy fit into that equation?
Sure, we shouldn't be increasing taxes on working families. We should be maintaining Delaware's competitiveness. That means we need federal investment to tackle some of the big issues that the state is facing. But we can do that without raising taxes on working people. President Biden had proposed what was called the Build Back Better Act back in 2021, which would have provided universal affordable child care, paid family and medical leave, historic investments in housing and elder care and home care. And it was all paid for without raising taxes on anyone making under $400,000 a year. So anyone who tells you that we can't meet the needs of workers and families without increasing taxes on them hasn't done their homework, and they don't realize that there's a proposal right in front of us that will do just that.
Let's move on to immigration. There was a bipartisan border reform bill ready to go before many Republicans backed away at the behest of former President Trump. Would you support that bill if elected? And if so, do you view it as a first step with more to do?
Yes, I would absolutely support the border security bill that President Biden, Vice President Harris negotiated with congressional Republicans. It was ready to go. But as you mentioned, Donald Trump nixed it. Donald Trump gave his orders to his Republican followers in Congress, and they crashed a deal, a historic bipartisan deal that could have helped secure the border and also make our immigration system more efficient and humane for the people interacting with it. But unfortunately, we know that petty, toxic politics, partisan politics, too often get in the way of progress. That's why we need to elect people to Washington, D.C., who are willing to move past those incentives in our politics that push us into our silos and know how to find common ground to actually deliver for people. And frankly, it means electing Vice President Harris and now Governor Tim Walz to the White House and to the executive branch. It means flipping the House of Representatives and keeping Democrats in the Senate, because what the Republican Party in Congress has made clear over the last several years is they are unwilling to deliver bipartisan results unless Democrats are in charge.
Even if that bill did pass, going back to the question I asked, is that a first step? Would there be more to do in your mind, even if that bill does go through?
Sure. It's an important next step, but there is more to do. We have to make sure we're grappling with the millions of undocumented folks that are living here in the United States right now, which is why I would be supportive of what had previously been bipartisan consensus in support of a pathway to citizenship for those who are presently here, who are working and paying their taxes. Because at the end of the day, we have to make the system protect our country and secure our borders, but also guarantee that those who are living here, who are productive, contributing members of society, are able to come out of the shadows and live full, productive lives.
Following the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade, the issue of abortion has been left to the states, and that has created a patchwork, obviously, of approaches and left questions about other related reproductive issues like IVF. How do you feel? Well, first of all, do you feel Congress should step in some way? And if so, how?
Absolutely. During my time in the Delaware State Senate, as we have faced significant attacks on reproductive freedom from the Supreme Court, we've protected the right to choose in Delaware. We've made this state a safe state, a sanctuary state for patients and providers to get the full range of health care that they need, including the full range of reproductive health care. But we should not lull ourselves into a false sense of complacency here in Delaware, because the reality is, if Donald Trump and J.D. Vance get full control of the federal government, they will ban abortion nationwide. We should take them at their original word. We should look at what they've already done, and we should look at what they've done in Texas and Alabama and states like that where they do have full control. They will ban abortion nationwide if they have the opportunity, and that means they will ban abortion in Delaware. And so we need a strong pro-reproductive freedom champion in the United States House of Representatives. That's what I've been throughout my career. It's what I'll be in Congress, because we need to do what we've done in Delaware and enshrine reproductive freedom under federal law to guarantee that we're making it as difficult as possible for these Trump MAGA extremists to ban abortion nationwide, which they will do if given the chance.
I do want to talk about a couple of foreign policy issues, starting with Israel and Gaza. President Biden has been seeking a ceasefire in Gaza to no avail so far. What do you believe the U.S. approach should be in this very complex conflict?
Well, it is a complex conflict, and I think President Biden has been dealt a very difficult hand, but has navigated it with the statesmanship that we know is a hallmark of Joe Biden's career. I think, like so many people, I've been heartbroken with the images that I've seen on the news, from the October 7th terrorist attack to the war in Gaza, to the ongoing hostage crisis. And I yearn for peace, I think, like all good people do. That's why I've been so supportive of this administration's efforts to secure a long-lasting ceasefire that provides a bridge to the conclusion of this war and hopefully the establishment of a two-state solution that results in a safe and secure Israel and a Palestinian state free from the oppression of Hamas that is stable and able to thrive for the Palestinian civilians that call it home. That is the only path toward a truly sustainable peace in the Middle East. And the first step is securing the ceasefire deal that the United States has negotiated, that has historically been accepted by Israel, and that we need Hamas to accept as well, because that is the only path toward a peaceful resolution here.
The other major ongoing foreign policy issue is the war in Ukraine. Where do you stand on continuing to support Ukraine, specifically financially, as it seeks to fend off the Russian invasion that is now about 2.5 years old?
Well, there's no question that we have to continue to stand with our allies, including Ukraine, as they fend off the illegal invasion by Russia. We have to be clear that if we aren't supporting Ukraine in their effort to stave off Russia and to keep Ukraine a democracy with the right of self-determination, if we don't help Ukraine successfully push back Russian forces, there is a very real chance that the situation could escalate in Europe, because at that point, Russia would be on the fringes of the NATO alliance. And an emboldened Russia an emboldened Russia under a despot wannabe like Vladimir Putin could be capable of anything. And so in order to prevent the risk of a conflict that ensnares NATO, we have to defeat Russia in Ukraine. And that will only happen if the United States and our allies, including in the European Union, continue to support the Ukrainian military financially and with military support.
I do want to touch on climate change, because that is an issue that is both important domestically and obviously globally as well. What role can Congress play and the federal government play in best addressing climate change?
Sure. Well, we saw in the Biden administration and the Biden-Harris administration the most significant step of any nation on Earth ever to combat the existential threat of climate change with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which was a historic investment in addressing and preventing climate change. We have to build on that progress. We have to continue to invest in renewables, including guaranteeing that Delaware has the support necessary to fund our transition to renewable energy in this state. But we also have to build on that progress. Senator Coons has a bipartisan bill that would help to incentivize some of the larger polluters in our economy to continue to limit even further their carbon emissions. That should be at the top of the agenda. We've pulled the lever on funding. We should pull the lever on policy. We also have to invest internationally in preventing climate change, because the reality is climate change doesn't care about borders. And while we have done a lot here domestically in the United States, we've also got to make sure that there is a truly global response to this global crisis. I think those are the next steps, but we have a strong foundation to build off of with the Inflation Reduction Act. And look, this is a critical issue for Delaware, because we are the lowest lying state in the nation. And when we're talking about the costs facing families, we can't ignore the reality that for our coastal communities, climate change poses a real risk to their families, to their homes, to their very communities. And we can't ensure that we're addressing those long-term cost issues facing families if we're not protecting the values of the homes of the people who live in eastern Sussex and eastern Kent along the coast, who are at severe risk of not just extreme weather, but of course, rising sea levels.
I want to go back to something you kind of touched on at the beginning of all this, and it's something we were talking with each candidate in all races about, and that is this sense of addressing distrust in government, because it seems there is a stronger distrust of government and maybe particularly politicians at this point, and calls for more transparency and accountability. If elected, what role do you feel you could play personally in delivering greater transparency and accountability and building that trust in government?
Sure. I think that's a great question, because I think there are two drivers of distrust in government and in politicians right now. One is certainly a fear around government being in the pockets of the wealthy few, the fear that government isn't looking out for everyday people, the fear that either soft or hard corruption has crept into our politics and our government in too many instances through the power of money and influence. It's one of the reasons why in the Delaware State Senate, I have been the leader of the charge to combat corruption and actually passed bipartisan legislation that took Delaware's anti-corruption and public trust laws from some of the weaker laws in the nation to some of the strongest laws in the nation to prevent government corruption and restore public trust. Because when a person in a position of political power abuses their trust, they don't just victimize the people that they're abusing or the specific finances that they're abusing. They undermine our democracy itself. They commit a crime against our democracy itself by undermining public trust. But I think the second driver of the lack of public trust that people feel is the fear that government just won't work for them, that people won't deliver on their promises. Every 2 or 4 years, we hear elected officials and candidates come before people and talk about what they're going to do. And too often, they don't deliver on it. But I'm running as a candidate who said in 2019, when I announced my candidacy for the state Senate, we're going to pass paid family and medical leave. We're going to expand access to health care. We're going to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We're going to pass historic gun safety measures. We've been able to do all of those things and more in the Delaware General Assembly. I've delivered on the promises that I've made to the constituents I represent. And in Congress, I'll deliver for Delawareans. I'll deliver the policies that I promise in this campaign, because I know how to make government work better for people. And we can't address public trust unless we actually deliver for people and keep the promises we make in our elections.
You mentioned the idea of undermining democracy. And I'm curious, do you feel, based on what you just said, and kind of the level of rhetoric in politics right now, that democracy is at a risky tipping point at this juncture?
Without question. I think all of us know what's at stake. Democracy is at risk because there are far too many people on the cusp of power who've demonstrated, if not an indifference to democracy, outright hostility to democracy, outright hostility in honoring elections and honoring the will of the people, outright hostility to Congress functioning by fostering an insurrection. We've seen outright hostility by far too many people in our politics to democracy itself. But we also too often see hostility from politicians toward the people they represent. And that is unconscionable. And that puts democracy at risk. We have to build a government that respects everyone, people who agree with us and people who disagree with us. We have to have a conversation across disagreement. We do have to bring down the temperature in some of the rhetoric, because at the end of the day, democracy only works if we can have a national dialogue, if we view the people who vote differently than us, not as enemies, but neighbors who disagree. That's, I think, the Delaware way in so many ways, that we can disagree agreeably. We need more of that in Congress. It's how I've conducted myself throughout my time in the Delaware General Assembly, bringing Democrats and Republicans together on big issues, on really complicated issues. But we need people in Washington who are willing and able to bring their colleagues together, but also truly respect and see everyone that they represent, whether they are Democrats, Republicans, or independents.
I want to wrap up by asking you if there's an issue you feel we haven't discussed that is not getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle, and how you could address it if elected.
Well, look, I think that we all need to be focused squarely on the challenges that workers and families in our state are facing. Affordable housing and health care, affordable child care, paid family and medical leave, strong public schools. And we need to send people to Washington who understand those issues, but also understand how to deliver on those issues. That's why I've been endorsed by Congresswoman Blunt Rochester in this campaign to succeed her in the United States House of Representatives. It's why I've been endorsed by more than 25 labor unions across the state. It's why I've been endorsed by the Delaware Democratic Party, Governor Carney, and local elected officials of both parties, because they know that Delaware's next member of Congress needs to be qualified and effective from day one. Someone who will be able to deliver the policies and investments that Delawareans need. That's why they are supporting my campaign. It's why I'm running, and it's why I hope to earn the vote of Delawareans in September and in November.
That's Democratic candidate for U.S. House Sarah McBride. Our full conversation with her is available at DelawarePublic.org. A reminder, Delaware Public Media also reached out to three other candidates in this race, Republican James Whalen and Democrats Earl Cooper and Elias Weir. They did not respond to Delaware Public Media's requests for an interview. And stay with us. Legislation passed this year now allows human composting in the first state. We take a closer look at the process and its benefits. That's next on this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media.